the help of the Lord this morning, I want to talk to us about one of the great men of the Old Testament. There's some unique characters in the Old Testament. Melchizedek's one of them. Try to study out Melchizedek. Enoch's another one. All that Enoch represents. But the main character of Genesis 39 is also another one. You probably know the story of Joseph very well. You can go back to chapter 37. You'll find the beginning portion of Joseph's life there in chapter 37. 38 takes a little bit of a deviation from the story of Joseph, but I believe that chapter 38 is preparing what is all going on in the fullness of the story, but doesn't have a whole lot to do with chapter 39, is what we want to look at anyway. I don't know how, other than what we've sang and heard sung this morning, how a person in Joseph's place could be what he ended up being. How could a person deal with all that Joseph dealt with? You could probably sum up the life of Joseph, at least the portion of his life found in 37 and 39, with these words: bitterly wronged and fearfully tried. It seems to be the essence of Joseph's life in these two chapters. Imagine being in a family of his size, all of his brothers, and then imagine being hated by them. Not just disliked, but apparently there was some real hatred there. Joseph was hated, envied. It's probably the root of the hatred. They envied Joseph. They envied Joseph because Joseph was the especially loved son of his father. There's reasons for that. May not be proper reasons, but there were reasons for that. They envied him, they hated him. Because of that awful envy and that horrible hatred, they sold him into slavery. Now from some people's vantage point and from some people's thinking, they might think, well, that's better than what they had originally intended. They had originally intended to kill him. But I think that in the heart of Reuben, when he found out that his brother was no longer in that dry well or that pit, and when he was told that they sold him into slavery, perhaps he recognized the potential horrid side to that. Could possibly be worse than death. Have no clue where he was going, what he was being taken into in the midst of slavery. But the other brothers thought that that was a better option than to have his blood literally on their hands. I just really try to put yourself in Joseph's place as he's had that coat of many colors ripped off of him by his own brothers and thrown into that pit. All the pleading, all the begging. Anything he said went on deaf ears, or at least caused them to go into hysterics of laughter. Because he was at their mercy, and they didn't seem to have any mercy. Begging for his very life, only to find no one to care. What a horrible, horrible situation. What a horrible thing in the memory. Then when he's taken down to Egypt, he's sold to a man that we really don't know anything about his past. We don't know what he was like. He could have been a cruel, cruel master. And in the midst of that situation, of that home, of where he was a slave, remember, he was a slave, even though he was brought in and was promoted to be the upper echelon of slavery, he was still a slave. The scripture bears out that that was the temptation that was placed in front of him was a daily situation. It wasn't just a one-time temptation. Joseph threw off his coat and fled. It was a day after day, day after day. And then when he made that final rejection to Potiphar's wife, and he left his coat behind, giving credence to her lie against him, her slander against him, when his statement and his heart was saying, "Your husband has given everything that he owns into my hands. He has promoted me to the highest place in the house. He doesn't even know what he has any longer. He has given me everything except for you, his wife." But the bottom line of what he was saying there wasn't a sin against his master, but he said, "How can I do this thing and sin against God?" You see, that was the core of Joseph's life. It wasn't a big thing necessarily to him of sinning against Potiphar. The big thing to him was, "How can I do this sin against God?" Oh, I believe that he would not have sinned against Potiphar either, but the focal point was not that. Because of the slander, because of the lie, he was placed in prison for years on false charges. That's the kicker to the whole imprisonment, on false charges. There's not a single one of us that are looking forward to go to prison if we did something wrong, let alone going there on false charges. But Joseph was imprisoned because of false charges. But the essence then that follows all of this tragedy of Joseph's life could be summed up in the words of Beverly Carradine. He said, "From poverty he leaped to affluence, from obscurity to fame and power, from prison to a position next to the throne." What contrasts! But the incredible road that led him to that place. I can look around and I see people that endure hardness or burdens. Some of them endure them year after year, year after year, on and on and on and on. But others, when hardship comes, they turn to drunkenness, they turn to suicide. Some of them turn to hysterics. Leads to insanity. They can't cope. They can't function. Maybe you've known somebody that in the midst of a sudden tragedy or a very difficult circumstance, they lost all semblance of control. What is the difference between those kind of people and people that endure year after year hardship, and many times people around them don't even have a clue that they're dealing with hardship? Could it possibly be the difference would be that of their educational background? Some of them have learned how to cope through education. Could it be that they've learned how to cope because they have studied the psychological functions of the mind or the innermost workings of the human intelligence, and so they have learned somehow to cope better than somebody else. Well, maybe it's not education, maybe it's just simply their temperament, their makeup. You know, we're all made up differently. Some of you have very little emotion, and some of you, or some of us, me, would have maybe sometimes a little too much emotion. Yes, there's a lot of difference in emotional backgrounds or temperament. Maybe it's not education, maybe it's not temperament, maybe it's just our upbringing, where we've come from, what side of the tracks we were born on, what kind of an environment we were brought up in. You know, that's a big issue in our society today, the environment in which we live. Although some people out of poor, horrible environments have ascended quite high on the social scale, and then some on the higher end that we've had all the opportunities have descended to the worst. It's amazing how many people go to Barberton Rescue Mission or to Fort Myers Rescue Mission who have backgrounds such as you and I. It's not that they lived on Skid Row and they continued to go there, but many times they've had things and they've had opportunities and they end up there. So it really can't be upbringing that makes the biggest difference, is it, or could it be? What is it that could possibly have the resounding difference, or make the resounding difference between what people do with their burdens, whether they hang on and endure or they turn to some kind of another avenue to ease their mind or ease their troubles? Could it be summed up in the words that are found here in Genesis chapter 39, three different places in this chapter speaking about the life of Joseph? Verse 2, verse 21, and verse 23. And the Lord was with Joseph, and he was a prosperous man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. Verse number 21. But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. In verse 23, the keeper of the prison looked not to anything that was under his hand, because the Lord was with him, and that which he did, the Lord made it to prosper. I think that perhaps some people, if we had to go through what Joseph went through, we would be found on a different plane than what Joseph was found on. We would probably fret over the imprisonment. It might even bring us to the point that we would strike out at the jailer. We would afflict our fellow prisoners, clanking our chains and railing at people every opportunity we could get because we had been wrongfully accused and imprisoned. How could it possibly be? How could it possibly be that Scripture would bear out that the Lord was with Joseph when all of these bad things came his way? You're telling me that God was with him and his brothers were able to sell him into slavery? Are you telling me that God was with him and he was in Potiphar's house and the false accusations came and God didn't stand up for him? You telling me that God was with him while he was in prison and he had opportunity to take his name to the very throne for pardon because of the king's servant that was released from prison and restored to the palace, but in his humanity he forgot Joseph? Are you with me on that high and low right there? This man's going back to the palace. He's going to carry Joseph's name back to the king. There's a possibility of a pardon, only to find out as the days slowly slip by that this person forgot him. And he plunged again to the new low and emotional feeling. You telling me that God was with him in the midst of all of that? It is hard to endure unjust treatment. It is fearful to be persistently wronged for years. It is a bitter trial to have a door of iron, as it were, shut in the face by human hands and have to wait for the divine opener and divine opening. The human instinct is to take the matter in our own hands and knock down the gate or dig underneath and escape. Well, Carradine says it so well again. The human instinct. Begin to work on the door, break down the lock, dig out from underneath. Try things on our own. But the Scripture tells us that the Lord was with him and made everything his hand touched prosper. If God is with a man, the hour of complete and perfect deliverance is certain to come. Let that sink in just a little while. If God is with a man, the hour of complete and perfect deliverance is certain to come. Think about it for a little bit. In your mind, go over to the book of Esther. What takes place in Esther? King Ahasuerus is on the throne. Esther has been placed as the queen for such a time as this. Those are some profound words that we cling to even today. For such a time as this, Haman was doing his very best to destroy the Jewish nation. Mordecai sat at the gate. That's all he did, was sat at the gate, and he drove Haman to insanity. Yes, it was insanity, because what Haman was attempting to do was ultimately working against him. And how did it all take place? Did Mordecai begin to work and to send notes to the king? No. Mordecai sat. I don't know how many of you ever heard Brother Mitchell preach that message, but that was his title, Mordecai Sat. Pretty good. But the door began to open one night when God brought a restlessness to the king. And in the midst of that restlessness, he began to look over some of the records and he found some things, and the door began to open to where ultimately the scheming Haman was brought to light. But it was in God's time. Isn't that something? When God is with a man, he is also for that man. And if God be for him, say it with me, who can be against him? You got it, didn't you, without me saying it first? If God is with a man, or with a person, then he is also for that person. And if God be for us, who can be against us? No matter what the circumstances, no matter what the trial, no matter what the test, no matter what is placed in our pathway, God sees, God understands. God knows. I heard Benjamin praying this morning when he was called on to lead in Sunday school. He made mention something to do with that. That God knows. God has to approve everything. That ought to give us new light on what is taking place in the circumstances of our lives. We see through a glass darkly. We see so small of a segment of our world, so small of a segment of our picture. I know that you and I can look at the life of Joseph. We can read it its entirety. We see all the tragedy that takes place, and we also see all the victory that follows and all the grandeur that comes because his ascension to the throne, the preservation of life. All that's involved with Joseph. We see the end, and so we Many times, because we see the end, forget about all the tragedy, and we minimize the reality of that tragedy. But you see, Joseph didn't see what was taking place at the end either until he got there. I don't believe for a moment that God gave him the understanding of how he was going to get to the point where the sun, moon, and the stars were going to bow down to him, or the sheaves of wheat were going to bow down to him. I don't think he had any understanding whatsoever of how it was going to happen. And perhaps those dreams that he had became a mockery even to his own mind. Because in the midst of the imprisonment, in the midst of the slavery, in the midst of all that had gone wrong, the enemy very well could have brought those dreams to his mind as a mockery to him. The reason why I believe that is because I've seen God or the enemy do that very thing to humanity in our day. The thing that you want to cling to, the thing that you want to have faith for, the thing that you feel like you've prayed through on, but somehow it seems like it's completely gone. It's impossible to take place. And because you prayed through, you thought you prayed through, the enemy brings it to your mind as a mockery to your soul. There are some things that I feel like God's working, or that I feel like God's wanting. But at this point, it's impossible. There's no possibility. And so sometimes I stop and I think about that circumstance or that situation, and my mind is being mocked. Because. But you see, God has a reason for every detail of our lives. Do you believe that? Do you believe every detail of our lives is in control by His hand? He works in the affairs of mankind to work out His purpose, His plan, His desire, so that you and I can stand back and say that on every human fetter can be engraved these words, "This shall fall off." On every prison door it can be written, "This shall open." The cry of the lonely prisoner within can be sung to him, "You shall yet come forth." You see, that's what could have been said to Joseph in those years of toiling and laboring there with a smile on his face in prison. That's incredible. That's incredible. It all comes down to what? Four words. Not his environment, not his educational background, not because of his emotional background or his makeup. It comes down to the four words that God allowed to be penned in relationship to the life of Joseph. God was with him. There's some powerful words for you and for me this morning. Now, of course, the question must be answered, is God with us? Or is God with me? There's a lot of people today that believe that God's on their side. God's with them. Someone recently told me about an individual who's professing to be a Christian, professing to have forsaken a wicked lifestyle, but ultimately, still secretly, it's going on. But making the profession and apparently believing that everything is well, everything is good, everything is okay, God is with me. And by the appearance that you and I might see, what we see of that individual, it may be that it looks like God is with them. Because normally we think that a person with prosperity has God's hand with them. And when there's not prosperity, then God, oh no, I know we're not necessarily standing up rebuking people in the midst of their tragedy. But sometimes it's easier to think that God's with them when they're prosperous rather than when they're not quite so prosperous. But the scripture tells us that God was with Joseph when he was not prosperous in the human standpoint. He was a slave, sold into slavery from a rich and wealthy home, sold into slavery, lied about, slandered, placed in prison on false charges, and then remained there because a person forgot him. That doesn't sound very prosperous. Yeah, he may have been prosperous in his own little cell, as it were. But what about, is God with me? If that is the basis for how people function in life, if that is the basis for how a person gets along in life, if that is the basis for what puts them on the path to ultimate success, then what is it in, or how is it in our own personal life? God was with him. Because the Lord was with him, and that which he did, the Lord made it to prosper. The Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy, gave him favor in the sight of the keeper. The Lord was with Joseph, and he was a prosperous man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. You see, if God is with a man, then he is also for that man. And if he's for us, who can be against us? I listened to the messages that Mark Cravens preached a few weeks ago this week. And I especially loved his clarity on Hebrews 12. Wherefore we are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses. You see, we've got people that have already gone on before us who they see the big picture now. And if they could testify to us today, they'd say, keep on. Keep on doing what you're doing to serve God and to be faithful to Him and be obedient to Him. Keep on. Keep on. Don't be caught up by the things of this world. Don't be taken down by the beggarly elements. Stand true, stand firm. Even when imprisonment would appear to come, a spiritual imprisonment or an emotional imprisonment or whatever it might be that comes and brings us some kind of a bondage, continue to press forward, believing and trusting and being obedient to God, knowing that God, when He is for a person, who can be against Him? I don't know what you're facing exactly, but I do know that if you're doing anything for God, you're facing the enemy. If you're doing anything for the Lord, you're being fought by the enemy. If you're walking obediently to the Lord, you're having some conflict with the enemy. But if God be for us, who can be against us? Four words. And if we live pleasing to God, they can be the commentary of our lives as well. God was with him. Let's stand together this morning.